It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll talk to the organizer of a Milwaukee choir whose members suffer from Alzheimer's disease.
First, the total number of homicides in Milwaukee so far this year reached 85 this weekend with the shooting death of a 35-year-old man. That number, 85 people killed, is only one homicide shy of the total number for all of 2014. Last week alone, 10 people were killed.
With homicides up more than 100% over last year and recent killings including alarmingly young victims and suspects, like the shooting of one 13-year-old by another 13-year-old, the national media has taken notice. Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn has blamed weak gun laws. He told USA Today that the sound of gunfire is so commonplace in Milwaukee that about 80% of gunshots detected by shot spotter sensors aren't even called into police by residents.
Here with us to talk about the spike in homicides is Ashley Lutheran, breaking news reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Ashley, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
So last week got the name Bloody Week in Milwaukee. What happened?
Last week, we had just a continuation of deadly violence that the city has seen, actually dating back to December of last year. I believe police officials started noticing it, but last week it really seemed to come to a head, especially at the end of the week. We had a 13-year-old boy, Giovanni, who was shot and killed, and that occurred the same day that charges were filed against a 15-year-old in the shooting death of 14-year-old Tariq Akbar, who was shot and killed after the fireworks at Milwaukee's lakefront.
Police Chief Ed Flynn said that in some cases, 80% of the shots registered on ShotSpotter aren't even being called into the police department. What does that tell you about the normalizing of violence in some Milwaukee neighborhoods?
I think there's no doubt that in some Milwaukee neighborhoods, gunfire is very common. I think particularly when you talk about ShotSpotter and the fact that police found after they installed this system, which picks up and verifies sounds of gunfire, when they realized that only 14% of the shots were actually being called in, that speaks to a couple of things. One, it speaks to perhaps people becoming used to it, and also people calling in to the police and maybe not getting the response that they would like. You know, if they report a shooting, but they don't know for sure that it was gunfire, maybe they just think it was the sound of gunfire. That doesn't give police a lot of information. That might make it a lower priority call. But gunfire, there's no doubt that gunfire is quite common in some neighborhoods in Milwaukee.
So again, we're talking about an over 100% increase in gun violence as compared with last year. Are we starting to have a handle on why Milwaukee is seeing a spike like this?
I think it's important to keep in mind that right now this is something that lots of major cities are dealing with. There have been spikes in Chicago and Baltimore and other cities around the country. And as we reported back in April when it first started to look so dramatic in terms of an increase year to year, we don't quite have enough data to show this is a sustained trend. We obviously know that there's a spike this year. It remains to be seen if this is an anomaly or not. But you always have to remember that this, we talk about trends and data, but you know, these are real people losing their lives. And I think someone at the vigil for Tariq said it best, and they said that everybody is somebody to someone. And so I think that's important to keep in mind as we're talking about this. It's not just numbers, it's people and families and neighborhoods.
We've been following an evolving story about the relationship between police and minority communities across the country, and Milwaukee has had some high-profile cases that get at that, including the Dontre Hamilton case. Do you see that as an aspect that may bear a closer look?
Absolutely. I think anyone you talk to in neighborhoods or police officers will say there's always room for improvement between the two. I mean, the police need the relationship of the community to solve crimes, and the community has to be able to trust the police and their response, and anything to increase that trust, I'm sure, would go a long way towards violence prevention. I think the degree to which that is playing a role depends on who you talk to. I will say, I believe it was Chief Flynn who said either during a press conference or during an interview that he believes that some role may be played by police officers who feel that they're under a microscope and that they are perhaps not engaging as they used to, and they feel, and you know, he said that's totally understandable because of the current climate that they're operating in. And again, he stressed that may only be one piece. So it's certainly on the minds of a lot of people here in Milwaukee.
Now, Chief Flynn also has been quoted as blaming what he calls absurdly weak gun laws. Have gun laws changed at all between last year and this year?
So there have been some changes. State lawmakers have rolled back the 48-hour waiting period for handgun purchase, which then prompted, once again, some state lawmakers to propose universal background checks, with their argument being, if you can so quickly do a background check that we don't need a waiting period, then why not do background checks for all gun sales, you know, private gun sales, gun show sales, that sort of thing.
And how are other city officials and lawmakers responding to the spike in homicides?
You have various responses. We're already in the middle of a mayoral campaign here in Milwaukee. You have some candidates for mayor, like Alderman Donovan, who has put forward some plans, one of the centerpieces of which is adding more police officers, which has been a consistent stance of his and position. And then you have Alderman Joe Davis, who I believe it was just on Friday, issued a news release saying he would prefer to redirect community development block grant money to organizations serving neighborhoods directly. And, you know, you have lots of different proposals. I think there is a frustration because people who work in this field, city leaders, they think we have examples of success. We have programs that seem to be working, but they are frustrated perhaps by this continuing violence and this continuing escalation. And so I think I would hope that there would continue to be a really large public debate about what should we be doing? Is the city doing enough? What else is out there? What haven't we considered?
So you mentioned a couple of proposals there. People have ideas, but are you seeing any sort of cohesive plan moving forward?
As far as what's been put out in the public realm, there hasn't been a cohesive vision or plan articulated by city leaders. There have been different proposals. There hasn't really been a coalescing of all these ideas saying, we agree that we need to address these areas and this is how we're going to move forward.
Now, you mentioned that other cities have been seeing the same sort of spike in homicides, and Milwaukee's not alone. Chicago, St. Louis, a couple of the other cities. In some places, synthetic drugs are being blamed as part of the problem there. Do you see that as being part of what's happening in Milwaukee?
I honestly haven't heard that in relation to Milwaukee. I think in Milwaukee, a lot of the causes that have been identified are, you know, a lot of arguments and disputes being resolved with gunfire. And the Homicide Review Commission, year after year, continues to tell us that, you know, four main factors of being a victim of a shooting or deadly violence in the city of Milwaukee is that you are with someone you know, one or both of you is under the influence of alcohol or drugs, so that could, you know, that could play in with the synthetic drugs. One or both of you is armed with some type of weapon, and then you have an argument. Those are the four factors that seem to be most commonly present during a non-fatal shooting or a homicide in the city of Milwaukee.
And as far as you know, have there been any budgetary changes in law enforcement that could account for the spike this year?
Well, I think that's been a long-term theory supported by the Milwaukee Police Association, the police union. You know, they've said that we need positions to be filled, we need to get rid of furloughs, and so I believe that, you know, they would relate that back to budgets. We've done stories in PolitiFacts about, you know, staffing levels in the police department. And I think that that's one issue that tends to keep coming up. I don't know. There hasn't been any big, massive cut that I'm aware of year to year. I think it's been a sustained concern of, for example, the police union, that these positions aren't being filled and that furloughs keep happening.
And Ashley, before we let you go, is there any sense about whether this trend we're seeing in Milwaukee and other cities like Baltimore, New Orleans, Chicago is a blip, an anomaly, or it's a meaningful national trend?
I think at this moment, yes, it's a national trend. Multiple cities are seeing this, but I think you're right in that it remains to be seen. We just need more information and more data if this is going to be a sustained problem. Is this marking a new normal? Is this just an anomaly? Is this just a spike in the years? I mean, in 2013, the city of Milwaukee recorded 105 homicides. That's a number that it hadn't recorded since 2007. So you need longer periods of data to be able to make that type of an assessment.
Ashley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica.
That was Ashley Luthern, breaking news reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about the dramatic spike in homicides in Milwaukee this year. This weekend, that number reached 85 homicides, only one shy of the total number for all of 2014.
Time for Wisconsin Life. Alzheimer's disease could steal a lot of memories, but one thing that often remains is music. An innovative choir in Milwaukee brings together people with Alzheimer's and their caregivers in song.
Weekends are usually quiet at the Milwaukee High School of the Arts. But for a few hours on Saturday mornings, the Amazing Grace chorus fills the band room with song. The singers come from diverse backgrounds, but they share one thing in common: memory loss. Some singers experience memory loss themselves, while others come with their loved ones to sing and to remember. Dementia may have stolen the memories of some of the choir members, but it hasn't taken their music. The chorus began in 2014 as an outreach project of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute. The organization was contacted by Dr. Mary Middleman, a researcher studying the positive effect of singing on mood in caregivers and people with memory issues in New York. The Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute brought the program to Milwaukee. Besides the benefits of song, outreach specialist Stephanie Houston says they hope to reduce negative attitudes toward memory loss, particularly among African Americans.
I think what we find is that in a community like the African American community, where we know that African Americans are twice as likely to be affected by Alzheimer's disease, there's still that stigma. And so having this chorus program is also groundbreaking in this city, and it's gotten people to talk more, and that's what we want people to do, and we want to reduce that stigma.
Practices are led by an all-star team of conductors. Among them, Vontae Jones.
I knew that music captivates the mind and helps the memory, because if I tell you something, you might not remember exactly what I say, but if I play the keys, if that's one of those songs that you remember, it'll trigger something, time, place, where I heard it. So the fact that I could help them through musical therapy was one of the main things or reasons why I did it. It's been a journey. I mean, when they first came in, they didn't know us, so they didn't really take to us at first. About the fifth week, we were all family.
Ella McKinley comes to rehearsals with her husband, James.
Yeah, we both like music, and I was really glad when they came with the choir that we could sing in together.
One week, he sang a solo.
He sang "Precious Lord, Take My Hand" a few weeks ago, and I just choked up because I hadn't heard him sing all the way through like that, in key and everything. This music has definitely been helping him, and it's been a blessing.
Pearl Cannon didn't consider herself a singer, but she came for her husband. And in return, she found a community.
I think people shouldn't isolate because they have memory situations. It's not a shame in it. It's not a mental illness. You know, it's not a death sentence, and there's still hope and things that you can do.
These guys are amazing. And it's by grace that we get to see them every week.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Joining us now to tell us more about the Amazing Grace Chorus is Stephanie Houston, Outreach Specialist for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute of Milwaukee. Stephanie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we think of Alzheimer's, and I think we think of loss, of what's gone, what's left behind. What is it like to see people, the families, the people suffering from Alzheimer's, come out of this very positive experience with this choir?
It is truly amazing. It is life-changing to see the changes of individuals who sometimes, because of the impact of the disease, it can affect their mood. And so to be able to see them, it's almost as if they are regaining another part of themselves. And it just is just wonderful to see, and it's so inspiring. They are truly, as their name is entitled, Amazing Grace Chorus. They are truly some amazing individuals to work with.
There's been some science in recent years about how people who may not be able to carry on a conversation because of memory loss issues, they can sing whole songs from their life, from earlier years, and they stay with them. Do we know anything about why that is, why some of those musical memories get embedded so deeply?
You know, there has been increasing studies in regards to how music is related to memories and how you know, the response in regards to some of those autobiographical memories are not as affected by Alzheimer's disease. And so what we have is seeing those individuals who have the ability to, whether they're singing or playing an instrument, that it can take them back to a time and a place, or it just evokes those autobiographical memories that definitely affects the brain. So to be able to think about sing a song that will take you back to a time or a place that you really enjoyed, it's truly amazing.
I've heard advice for people who are friends or family members of people with Alzheimer's, and I think this comes out of a storytelling project in the Milwaukee area. Mm-hmm. Don't focus on what isn't there. Don't keep asking, don't you remember, don't you remember. See what you still have and work with that and build on it. And it seems like this choir is a great example of one way to do that.
The choir is a great example. It does not put limitations on the individuals, and it does require them to really develop a lot of different skills in regards to just their cognitive functioning, their ability to focus, pay attention, and also their language fluency, which is also important. And so this is just really so important to that individual in regards to how singing is impacting them cognitively by being involved, being engaged. Music stimulates every lobe of the brain, and that's what we have when we have choir rehearsal.
How does the choir pick its music and find stuff that appeals to everybody?
We have some wonderful conductors who initially, and I want to be able to mention their names, Miss Arlene Skorowski, music educator, Mr. Vante Jones, Mr. Micah Shaw, and also Mr. Casey Williams, and also Joe Nathaniel Jr. And so our conductors, we were able to get some of the most talented conductors in the areas, and they really put together songs, historical songs, and they also put together a variety of songs of today's music, so some contemporary and hymns and gospels together, and that was during our first season. The second season, here you had chorus members who said they wanted to sing their own songs and brought songs that they wanted to sing to the chorus. And matter of fact, as we enter into our new season in August, some of them will be singing some country western music as well. So it is so wonderful to see how much when the conductors first initiated and presenting them with music, now they are bringing their own songs that bring about memories and bring them joy to the chorus.
And does this all work toward each season or performance or performances for the choir?
It does. We initially, when we engage the families, you know, try to definitely press upon them that this is going to be a 16-week commitment to be in the chorus. So we do about 15 weeks of rehearsal. We do that 16th week is a family presentation or concert. We didn't want to overwhelm them and say, you're going to be in concert. So we called it also a family presentation. And then we come back together in the 17th week and we talk about the experience of being in the chorus.
Now, we heard a quote in that lovely piece about how at the end of 5 weeks, the group was like family. And Alzheimer's, memory loss, this is a challenging thing for a lot of people, a painful thing. How does that group function like a family?
What we have experienced is that they have created their own community within the community. As we have continued on with the rehearsals, because they rehearse and then they have breaks, so they socialize, and we find out how people have either worked at, you know, at local places together. Two of the members, they are veterans, and they attend the Vets Place Day Program Center together. And so they have really, really been able to just develop a community within the community. We have one of the individuals, Ms. Pearl Cannon, who brings her husband. She actually runs a support group for the Alzheimer's Association. So this has been just such a unique experience. And Dr. Mary Middleman, who approached us about this course, that was one of her goals, in order to create a community in which people feel supported and comfortable about having and caring for someone with dementia. But what we do see is that everyone interacts with one another.
And we leave it there. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Stephanie Houston is the Outreach Specialist for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute of Milwaukee, and we've been talking about the city's Amazing Grace Chorus.
Governor Walker's proposal to cut $300 million from the UW system has gotten a lot of attention since he announced his budget in February. That number has since been reduced to $250 million, but apart from higher education, the budget the governor signed has significant implications for K-12 education in the state as well.
One of the biggest changes affects Milwaukee's public schools. The law now allows Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abele to appoint individuals to oversee a number of failing schools, with the possibility of more influence from independent charter companies. The budget also includes an expansion of voucher schools throughout Wisconsin. Here with us now is Aaron Richards, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's education reporter. Aaron, welcome back.
Hi, thank you.
Well, let's talk first about funding. What does K-12 funding look like under the new budget for the next couple of years?
Essentially, public schools are held flat in the first year of the budget. You could argue, well, supporters certainly do argue that that actually amounts to a cut. We all know costs go up every year. Inflation, you know, raises the cost of everything. So being held flat in the first year, you know, the public school advocates say, you know, that's, you're kind of cutting us. You know, certainly on the other side, folks say, well, you know, it's better than the $127 million that you would have lost that was proposed in the earlier version of the budget. In the second year, public schools get a little bit more funding, but it's modest. It's a modest increase, and it's not up to the rate of inflation. There are some other, you know, more specific budget items on that, but for the most part, that's where public schools stand right now.
Is that spending affecting school districts evenly, or are some districts getting a bit more and others a bit less?
School finance is always affected by, you know, a lot of other factors for each district. In school, the aid that comes to schools is greatly affected by, you know, the property wealth in the district. Where schools are getting their money from depends on the property wealth in the district, the run through the school funding formula. Most districts get some state aid as well. They get a lot more state aid if they don't have as, you know, if they're not a rich property area. So certainly districts will be impacted differently. And at the moment, it's up to budget directors and the administrators of school districts to see, okay, you know, now that we have a better idea of where the budget is, we can go forward and, you know, sort of plan for the future now that we know what the next 2 years are going to look like.
The state superintendent of schools, Tony Evers, had publicly asked the governor to use that veto pen for some of these education-related items. Do we know what the superintendent asked for and whether the governor responded?
Yeah, Tony Evers asked for a lot. In his veto request, spanned about 14 pages, included more than 20 measures, including everything from the most controversial stuff, you know, significantly expanding the statewide voucher program, you know, implementing other provisions, even down to sort of nitty-gritty stuff like cutting funding to what are called cooperative education service agencies. We call them CESAs. They're like regional groups funded by the state with a little bit of state money, but mostly with money from local school districts that help school districts with training, or they sometimes provide shared special education services. That's another one. Just didn't get much attention because it's really under the radar. But Tony Evers asked for the governor to veto all of that. In the end, Walker vetoed very little when it came to the K-12 policy items in the budget. I'm not sure if he acted on any of the ones proposed by Evers.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Milwaukee Public Schools. There is a plan in this budget, which is, it's called a, in some instances, it's referred to as a takeover plan. Can you tell us about how that affects failing schools going forward?
At the moment, all of the schools that are part of the Milwaukee Public Schools family are, ultimately, they answer to the Milwaukee School Board, 9-member board elected officials. Under this plan, some of the district's lowest performing schools, those are schools that have received failing grades, or at least they've fallen into the lowest performance category on state report cards, almost universally, these schools are very high poverty, and they have, you know, they're in tough neighborhoods, and they've long had patterns of underachievement. Some of those schools would be turned over to the Milwaukee County Executive, but the county executive would appoint a commissioner, we don't know who that person's going to be yet, to oversee those failing schools. So those schools would answer to an independently appointed commissioner instead of the school board. The state legislation also calls for the state, the MPS superintendent, Darian Driver, to also have some direct autonomy over some of those schools. And in the coming months, we're going to see how this will actually be put into effect. It's pretty early now, you know, how this will actually shake out and what schools will be chosen for this kind of treatment is going to be kind of a question mark, and we're watching that moving forward.
Is this model, this takeover model, one that's been tried in other states?
Absolutely. Louisiana is one of the sort of the best-known examples. There was already a state-run school district before Hurricane Katrina, but certainly after the hurricane, a lot more of those New Orleans public schools were put into this recovery district, which was not run by the traditional school board, but it was independently run. In the long term, it mostly amounts to more independent charter management companies taking over these schools and running them like independent businesses rather than as a network of schools. And that would likely be what would happen here. At least it would if it's Tennessee has a couple of these districts as well, where there's just a lot more opportunity for the schools to be independently run rather than sort of the traditional, you know, answer to a school board and a traditional school administration structure.
So just to play that out, what would happen would be the school would fail, and Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abele would appoint a commissioner to oversee the school, and that commissioner could then choose to bring in an independent outside group to run the school.
Yes. And the way the language is written in Milwaukee, it would also allow a private voucher school operator to take over the school. But they did try to limit that to say that it would have to be, they wouldn't be able to teach religion under that provision. So it's unclear if a voucher operator would step up. A lot of them are in the program because they want to teach religion in schools.
Now, you mentioned Louisiana as a state that's also trying this approach. Do we know if it's been effective at turning schools around in Louisiana?
Well, it depends on who you ask. And the research is a little bit mixed. It has not been a magic bullet by any means. On some measures, more kids are graduating in some schools. Some schools have been more successful than others. I think there are some far-reaching consequences that nobody's really sure what to make of yet. For example, a lot of the traditional teaching staff, which was a lot of Black educators, were fired as part of that whole change, and a whole lot of young white educators were brought to the city instead. And so, you know, there's some long-term effects of, you know, diversity and sort of what's going to happen later on. You know, special education services are done much differently when each individual school oversees that, and you don't have the sort of mass capacity of a district to help oversee some of those services. So in some cases, it's quite mixed.
And looking at special needs, you mentioned that. Let's talk about the special needs voucher. This was a change in the budget as well. Could you tell us what that is?
The special needs voucher program is something that conservatives had pushed in the last couple of budget cycles, and it just ran into opposition from every disability rights group. Which is a big signal. You know, the disability rights groups are very interested in the well-being, safety, and betterment of kids and adults with disabilities. They really don't like this plan because it would allow a child with a disability to essentially leave the public school district and take a publicly funded voucher to go attend a private school. The spirit of that change is that some parents may be not getting the services that they think are best for their child in the public school. And so the conservatives that pushed this plan and inserted it in the 11th hour in the budget wanted to make sure that they had the funding to go and attend a private school if they wanted to. Now, there's also a change in the budget that allows, changes the state's open enrollment program to be more friendly toward kids wanting to leave one public district for a different public district, and it says that they can't be denied because of their disability. A lot of the folks on the public school side and in the disability community said, you know what, that's enough of a change to be able to allow you out of your district to go somewhere else. But a lot of the folks on the public school sides are concerned about that, the more kids with special needs that sort of leave the funding system, the traditional funding system, means that there's less money in the pot to basically serve everybody's needs. And I think there's some concern from the public school side of things as well that the people most likely to take their child out of a public school district when they have a child with a disability could potentially be parents of kids with fairly mild disabilities that aren't that difficult to serve, and that would mean that the kids with the most significant disabilities that cost the most to help and to, you know, assist in schools would be the ones left in the public districts.
We're talking right now with Aaron Richards, education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about changes to K-12 education in Wisconsin under the new state budget.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the changes we've been discussing? Do you think that voucher and charter schools should be expanded here in Wisconsin? Do you think these changes could have a positive influence in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation now with Aaron Richards of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about changes to K-12 education in Wisconsin under the new budget that Governor Walker signed yesterday.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the budget changes to education will affect your schools, your community? Do you want voucher and charter schools expanded in the state? Are you worried about funding levels for your school, the one you send your kids to, maybe the one you work at? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We go now to our callers. We've got Kim on the line in Oconomowoc. Hi, Kim.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up?
My concern about the failing school proposal is, does that student body remain the same? Because we talk about schools that fail, but really it could be that students are bussed from the school district from various areas to that school. And so if a charter school would take over, would it be the same students that made up the, quote, failing school, or would the charter school be able to start fresh and those students get pushed into the rest of the district?
Okay, interesting question there, Kim. Aaron, do you know?
There is some language in the provision passed that requires the school to serve at least up to a majority of students who were already in the school. I can't remember the exact language, but I know that there is attention to the fact that the school, if a new management company is invited to take over that particular public school, they are not allowed to summarily, you know, basically send all the students away and select all new ones. They do have to educate some of the kids that were there. I'm not certain if they have to educate 100% of the children that were in the school before. So that's something that we'll have to get, have to probably take a little bit closer look at. But there is some language that says that the school, you know, cannot start fresh. They are supposed to serve students that were in the school before.
Kim, thanks for the call. Next we go to Joanne joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Joanne.
Hi.
What is your comment?
Well, my question is whether the children in this new arrangement will have their progress academically followed year after year, I understand that this is not the case with some voucher schools today, and as it is in the public school system.
Okay, so got your question there, Joanne. Thank you for that. So Joanne asking, for children who choose to go to a charter school, a voucher school, how will their progress be tracked?
Two different answers to that. The tracking is somewhat different if a kid is in a charter school or a voucher school. That's because voucher schools are private. And at the moment, the only real performance outcome data that we have for them is when the kids take the same state test at the moment that the public school kids do. For everybody that takes that state test, it's getting harder to track from year to year because, for example, we implemented a new state test this year as part of the budget that has been thrown out because of some controversy tied to the Common Core and also the test itself. The state is now picking a new state test that everyone will take. But there's some concern about whether, you know, the budget also allows for schools to potentially pick from up to three tests. So getting a consistent test for anybody in any school system at the moment is a little bit difficult. As far as the voucher tracking is concerned, beyond the test itself, we don't have any other performance data for them that we can get publicly. So it is, in general, harder to track all of the different kinds of performance outcomes for voucher kids that we have for charter school and traditional public school kids because the public schools, we have more data to look at.
So, Aaron, just to follow up on the testing, so in the past, traditional schools, voucher schools, charter schools, they had to take the same standardized test. Now, going forward, it sounds as though that's no longer the case in the budget, as you said. So how many tests might we end up with?
Well, that's a little bit unclear. One of the vetoes that the state superintendent had asked for was a provision in the budget that required him, the state superintendent, to try to seek a waiver from the federal government from this provision that you administer one state test to your public schools and to allow up to three different tests to be chosen by folks. To my knowledge and from what I've read, that was not vetoed in the budget. However, at the moment, federal law still requires a state to administer one state test to its public schools. And while federal law doesn't say anything about what private schools have to do, our own state law in Wisconsin requires the private voucher schools, those are the ones that get public money, to take the state test. So at the moment, everybody is still taking the same state test, but going forward, this is probably going to take some, take some attention to figure out what's going to happen going forward.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. And we move on next to Joan in Whitefish Bay. Joan, hi.
Hi. This is so interesting because it really is a matter of great controversy, and I certainly hope the disadvantaged children or have the people who are handicapped have good access. But I think it's really wicked to take the money from the public schools, Milwaukee Public Schools, which has always struggled to get ahead and has had in the past a wonderful reputation. And I think for charter schools or voucher schools under private management is a travesty. I really feel for Milwaukee Public Schools and have always supported and advocated for them. But thank you so much for the opportunity to talk. Thank you.
Joan, thank you for calling. And in terms of the financial aspect of some money leaving the public schools, going to charter and voucher schools, do we know what sort of impact that will have?
That's a big question mark in the Milwaukee Public Schools budget at the moment. They've built their budget based on what they think they'll get from the state and, you know, what they anticipate, and they're usually pretty good at anticipating what they'll get in local tax dollars. But the ringer in this whole thing is how the structure of taking some schools away from the authority of the district and placing them in the hands of this commissioner appointed by the county executive, how that would actually affect the Milwaukee Public Schools budget. The lawmakers that support this quote-unquote takeover plan or opportunity plan, depending on what side of the fence you're on, they say it won't have that big of an impact. MPS officials have said they're not quite sure. In the very beginning, it probably won't be much anyway. It only about 3 schools would be affected in the beginning. It could be up to 5 schools later on. So certainly in the beginning, there aren't that many schools that would be involved, so the financial impact, or whatever it is, wouldn't be huge to start with, but we'd have to see how things would look down the road.
So supporters of that motion, the people who would like to see this money going to charter schools and voucher schools, what are they hoping to achieve? What is the rationale behind sending some extra money there to help?
Do you mean for the Opportunity Schools Plan?
Right, for the Opportunity Schools Plan.
Mm-hmm. Low-performing schools. Well, in some ways, this is really rooted in a belief that the Milwaukee School Board has been dysfunctional for a long time, that the school district hasn't been able to do enough over the years to help its low-performing schools get better. The public school community and MPS workers in general take offense to that characterization. They say, you know, that just improving a school takes far more than just expertise. You know, we're serving communities that are highly impoverished. Most families may not be intact. Fathers are absent. Jobs are hard to come by. This is generations of poverty and people who haven't been exposed to what good education could look like. So we're struggling with all of these other factors here. And the conservatives that push this bill really believe that we've exhausted the possibilities of, you know, reform from MPS, and that by changing the governance of these schools, by putting somebody new in charge that could shake up the staff, that wouldn't have to use union employees, that could hire fresh from, you know, worker one to however many workers you need in the school, that this could, you know, be something different that we haven't tried yet. So that's the real philosophy.
And Aaron, school accountability and how to measure that, that's been a hotly debated topic. Where did the budget leave it?
Well, we've got the testing issue, so you've got the fact that we're still figuring out what test to use for everybody, and that's going to have to be ironed out going forward. We've certainly got, on the federal level, you know, even beyond us here, we've got the No Child Left Behind bill that's trying to get rewritten in Washington, D.C. There hasn't been full consensus on that yet, but there's been some movement. We certainly have, you know, in terms of just keeping track of how all kids are doing, we've got a growing opt-out movement in Wisconsin where you've got still a small percentage of parents taking their kids out from taking the annual state test, but certainly we've seen more parents do that this year than in any other year. So there's a lot of question marks at the moment about how we're going to keep track of everybody and what's the best way to look at performance going forward. I think for the schools in Milwaukee that will be a part of this, you know, opportunity plan or takeover plan, you know, there will be a lot of attention paid to certainly the traditional measures that we often look at, you know, test scores, attendance, suspension rates, expulsion rates. Certainly we'll be looking at all of those as well. But, of course, all of these things take several years for, you know, really any meaningful data over time to come up.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
That was Aaron Richards, education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about changes to K-12 education in Wisconsin under the budget that Governor Walker signed yesterday.